Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 197, which is a prime number and therefore symbolic too, because this episode is dealing with a unique event in Southern African history, the Eighth Frontier War, which began on Christmas Day 1850. Was going to end eventually, although, as with all conflicts that stretch into years, most of those involved despair, believing perhaps the guns will never fall silent. A British government under Russell had come a cropper, partly because of the way in which this war had dragged on. It led to Sir Harry Smith losing his job as Cape Governor, and Sir George Cathcart had arrived to escort the conflagration to its spluttering expiration. Lord Earl Grey had lost his job as Colonial Secretary only a few weeks after he had fired Harry Smith. Among the Amakosa, things were actually not much better. The overall situation was different from the previous war because there was no longer any attempt at a central command or even unity of action. Chief Sandile of the Amanika had told his warriors to avoid gathering in large numbers, preferring quick and dirty small raids to anything large-scale. Committing acts of mischief of all kinds, as the British referred to it. For both the colonists and the Amakosa people who were just trying to get on with their lives, the unstable frontier was a torturous concoction of blood, sweat and tears. It was actually the Khoi Khoi rebels under leaders like Willem Eithalter who were determined to hold out whatever happened. This position was reinforced when the British conducted a show trial of a man who had been treated very badly by history, by the name of Andries Botha, a Khoi Khoi veteran former of the Cape Mounted Rifles. He faced two treason trials. The first ended in 1851, but the settlers bade for his blood as a former Cape Mounted Rifles commander who'd been accused of switching sides to fight with the Amakosa. As you'll hear, he hadn't. In May 1852, he was rearrested and marched into a court where Judge Sir John Wilde presided over what became known as South Africa's first show trial, foreshadowing others such as the Rivonia treason trials, where Nelson Mandela was sentenced to life on Robben Island. It was an unprecedented event, this 1852 show trial, the first of its kind in the Supreme Court of the Cape Colony. Previously, the trials had been dominated by the almost ritualized sentencing of rebellious slaves, but this one was the first politically charged trial taking aim at an indigenous person, a man of Southern Africa, not a rebellious slave from Madagascar or West Africa. Botha was defended by two of the Cape's top lawyers, Frank Watermeyer and Johannes Brandt. In what amounted to an unsightly rush, he was sentenced to death in spite of a strong defence. But the outrage that followed the death sentence meant it was commuted to life in prison. This story needs a little more attention. Yeah, I was a former war hero fighting for the British against the Amakosa in previous frontier wars. His commanders and supporters, such as John Maltino and Andries Stockenstrom, regarded him as one of the most courageous soldiers they'd ever known. The second reason to take a closer look was that he was not implicated directly in the Khoi Khoi uprising of the Cut River. He had tried to stop his sons, for example, from taking up arms against the British, and then had been forced to flee his home when other Khoi threatened to kill him for refusing to rise up and fight the colonials. His own family turned against him. Then so too did the colonists. The reason why he was dragged to court was because the settlers demanded a whipping horse, a symbolic sacrificial lamb, and were vindictive in their vituperation, visceral in their vengeance, and vacant in their venom. Andries Botha had been one of the chieftains of the Cut River settlement. His neighbour was Hermanus Matroos. The latter was very definitely one of the rebels. Botha had visited Stockenstrom just before the outbreak of the Eighth Frontier War to warn him that the evictions of the Khoi and the Amakosa in June 1850 were unfair, and saying that Governor Sir Harry Smith was going to cause a conflagration of note should he continue chopping off bits of the Eastern Cape and giving it to English farmers. Grievance against the system had gone too deep. Botha used the phrase oppression. The 70-year-old veteran, a man of poise and presence, had spent the first days of the Eighth Frontier War escorting British magistrate J.H. Vinant to safety at Fort Beaufort. He was shot at by the Amamfengu and survived this friendly fire incident. His sons had joined the rebellion, and influential missionary Henry Calderwood, who was a fierce imperialist, supported Botha. It was double irony then that even the bloodthirsty editor of the Grahamstown Journal, Robert Godlinton, referred to Botha as a man whose intrepidity and military skill, extending nearly over the whole of his active life, have won the highest eulogiums of his superior officers, and whose deeds of valour in the fastnesses of the Amatola are still fresh in the memory. Monitoring this trial were others such as Charles Lennox Stretch, who was far more realistic about what was going on, as well as missionaries who were profoundly disturbed. He was a man, a war hero, who'd saved hundreds of British soldiers by his valour, being harangued in court. The rumours spread that Judge Wilde had been told by Governor Cathcart to ensure that Botha would be hanged, even though the evidence against him appeared to point towards innocence. Journalist John Fairbairn, the man who'd been promoting responsible government and one of the supporters of colonialism and a new power ethos in southern Africa, was also horrified by Botha's treatment. Writing in the South African Commercial Advertiser, Fairbairn said, "This man, since his arrest, has been pursued by a portion of the frontier press and by some individuals there with a bloodthirstiness positively diabolical." As diabolical as that Scots accent. When justice turns to vengeance, there are secondary effects that are often ill-considered. The entire evidence against Botha was that once in his long career, he'd been involved in a case of his own form of friendly fire, and those who lined up to claim this were seven Khoi Khoi rebels serving life sentences. No one with a shred of logical thinking believed that evidence. It was the first time that convicts for life had been placed in a witness box to prove a crime of high treason. Most believed they'd come to palliate their own conduct. For the last few months, these seven prisoners, the malevolent seven, let us call them, had been breaking rocks building a mountain pass near Cape Town. They sensed a way out of their chain gang sentence. Furthermore, the problem for the state's case was that Botha had an alibi that contradicted all evidence against him. A simulated trial began in May 1852. 8 days later, he was found guilty. What was perhaps the most shocking of all was the conduct of the Chief Justice, John Wilde. He seemed to delight in brutalizing this old man, profoundly vindictive as he shouted, "Prisoner, it is said that you have been one of the bravest men in the field. May you prove the bravest man on the scaffold. I have only now to pronounce the sentence that you be hanged by the neck until you are dead." So it is with some relief that you'll hear not only was the sentence commuted to life in prison, but 3 years later in 1855, Queen Victoria ordered his amnesty and his release. While he was still banned from his beloved Cut the River, in 1862 he received a substantial compensation for his properties and for his treatment, and finally he was allowed back home in 1865. Post 80 years old, this veteran found his life patched a little back together, but in reality it was too little too late. The land of the Khoi Khoi had been parcelled out to the settlers, no longer protected. It was broken up, sold off. Despite the horrific treatment meted out to Botha, in the coming years, he actually appeared in the Cape Town Colony Parliament, speaking in support of the colonists and their drive towards responsible government. Botha's treatment reinforced the Khoi Khoi rebels' belief they would not get a fair hearing should they surrender. After all, here was a man who was a hero for the British being so badly dealt with. What hope had they? The Amatxhosa were exhausted. In February 1853, Sir George Cathcart, like his predecessors, had tired of the greedy colonists making quite a bit of cash out of this war. They'd hiked up their prices for all goods, horses, oxen, feed, leather goods, food. After protracted negotiations, Sandile and Makoma surrendered, along with all their chiefs. They were pardoned by Cathcart, who had promised they would not be arrested like Siolo in exchange for this unconditional surrender. The British governor went further, declaring that henceforth no chief could be deposed by any official, although they could still be exiled for going to war. The Amatxhosa chiefs could not be deprived of any supporters, and Cathcart rescinded Harry Smith's crazy and arbitrary deposition of Sandile. However, what the governor giveth, he taketh away. The Amatolas, Macoma's traditional home, would go dark. There would be no home fires burning for Sandile and Seola and Macoma, because they would never return. Sandile had fought for his mountains, and now he'd lost them. Most of the Amatolas had already fled from the mountains, down into the lowlands along the rivers west of the Kai. The colonists were not satisfied. In fact, they were outraged. They demanded that Cathcart chase the Amatolas all the way east across the Kai River. There was a lot of land there, you know. But the governor refused. Sandile and the Amangrika people were given what amounted to a location, as it was known, between the Amatolas and the Kai. Anyone who has been a refugee will know the pain of memory, and particularly a memory that remains unresolved. This is what happened to Sandile and Macoma's people. The ancestors of the Amangrika had roamed through the woods and the forests of the Amatolas for centuries, gazing fondly at the purple summits, the animals browsing in the valleys, the kloofs, hunting grounds, full of game meat, ready for the snaring. It was with lingering regret that the Amangrika moved on, the moment described by some as an exodus. And now they were living with their backs to the Kai River, and like other upended people, they were prepared to listen to purveyors of magic, receptive to stories of burning bushes and perfect solutions, millenarianism and cultism. A catastrophic cattle killing was going to take place, but more about that in coming episodes. The peace settlement was officially proclaimed on the 2nd of March, 1853. A week later, the chiefs gathered to speak with Cathcart, who told them a new man was to manage their lives, Lieutenant Colonel John McLean. He had been the commissioner overseeing the Amantlambe people in British Kaffraria. Sir Henry Somerset was packed off to India, then to Gibraltar, where he would die in 1862. McLean had warned Smith about trying to destroy the Amatolas chief's power and the risks. He regarded Sandile's deposition as the main cause of this war, and Smith's refusal to change his mind as the main reason the war dragged on for so long. McLean, however, was also a man of his time. While he believed the bad policies had caused the war, he was also firmly of the belief that white settlers should take control of the Amatolas. He'd drawn up plans to do just that. Noel Mostat, the brilliant historian, credits John McLean with being the inventor of a special system of one-man sub-government, a person who was coldly detached while appearing intimate and who could play an immensely long game in politics. He developed a kind of hidden ability through which entire peoples across a vast continent would be ruled by others, a person who could attend to their own needs in the remote regions of colonial Africa south of the Sahara. Joseph Conrad would write of these folks in Heart of Darkness, practitioners who were zealous individual definers of imperial pulse and style. Cathcart, however, had a few surprises for Mr. McLean and the colonists. The British governor had been pondering things and hit on what he thought was the key to peace in the region. The Amatolas were, in his words, the crucial part of the puzzle, and a military occupation here would keep the Amatolas away forever. British Kaffraria was to continue as a separate territory to the Cape Colony under martial law, but it would not be open to any white settlement. There went McLean's immediate plan to settle the Amatolas. Simultaneously, the British government announced it was abandoning the Orange River sovereignty. All of Harry Smith's grandiose plans had been reversed. As Cathcart made these announcements, he was to utter a statement that still reverberates down the ages.
The foolish sovereignty farce is at length over, and we have done with it. The stories about gold are, if not entirely false, monstrously exaggerated.
Now, of course, hindsight is all very self-serving, but this was 3 decades before gold was discovered on the Witwatersrand. However, it was less than a decade away from diamonds being discovered in Kimberley. Great Britain's attempt at a kind of isolationism was going to be shaken by global finance. And so, dear listener, the end of the Eighth Frontier War was inconclusive. At first glance, it appeared the British had prevailed. The Amatolas had been vanquished.
It had cost close to £3 million. 16,000 Xhosa had died, 1,400 British and colonials. It had given the world something called the Birkenhead Drill, women and children first. It had also revealed to planet Earth a modern war where a guerrilla-style army with experience in the bush had forced a conventional army into unconventional tactics. The communications required in the Waterkloof, inside the ravines, meant for the first time British soldiers had received orders from officers who had no idea what was happening on the field, because the field was a jungle inside a ravine. They used bugle calls in the distance out of sight, a precursor to military use of two-way radios. It was the first war where a rifling bullet was used, a Minier conical bullet, muzzle-loaded but spinning and powerful. These were sent to South Africa as an experiment by the British Army. The war that had been stoked by Umlanjeni the Prophet, but powered by Smith, was a foretaste of what the Americans were going to experience in Vietnam. After March 1853, the Cut River settlement was sold off to settlers, and by the end of the year, most of the Khoi Khoi rebels had been put to death in macabre public events. Children would scamper to Execution Hill in Grahamstown. Schools would finish class early just so that the kids could take in the spectacle of a man drawing his last breath on a scaffold. Eyes glued on the figure dragged to his fate. Many of the children would listen to their parents speaking about these men and their last seconds, a topic of conversation in the coffee houses and the kitchens. The dehumanization of a people through the public termination of a life. After the Amaxhosa surrendered, many of the Khoi Khoi rebels faded away, at least those who survived being captured and executed. And what of Willem Eidelder, who had no safe house inside Kaferia in the Amatolas or Albany? He fled across the Kai River into the arms of a welcoming Amaxaleka chief, Sarili. While the welcome was not entirely warm, the Amaxaleka king did not send the remaining Khoi back across the Kai either. After a few months, though, Eidelder found himself almost alone and returned to King Williamstown, a moth to a flame. He stood outside a church one Sunday. The next day, he rode out of town into the hills, then slit his own throat. André Stokkenstrom was the next to go. His home destroyed, his library in ashes, his valuables collected in the Cape for a lifetime gone. That was a shock. As you've heard, the shock increased when he discovered that those who did it were not the Amaxhosa, but a British patrol instigated by editor Robert Godlinton. The dog whistling he'd been doing for so long was now paying off. Extremists listened to those who suggest things, even in jest. Stokkenstrom left his beloved Amatolas just like the Amaxhosa. But in Andries's case, it was to London, where he died in 1864, aged 71. And what of Sir George Cathcart? Well, he was called from South Africa and headed off to fight in the Crimea, where he was shot through the chest at the Battle of Inkerman and joined the long list of British dead in that war against the Russians. Others, such as Lieutenant Colonel Eyre, were also called to the Crimea. He was the man, if you remember, who'd been so successful in adopting the scorched earth policies and night patrols that had helped shatter the Amaxhosa. When Eyre left South Africa, he promised he'd fight in a more civilized fashion than he had in Africa. He'd been killing women and children in Africa, after all. Politically, times were changing. With Cathcart's departure, something arrived that was inhuman. Or to put it more correctly, it wasn't human at all. It was an envelope containing the Cape Colony's first constitution, which provided for an elected upper house called the Legislative Council and a lower house called the House of Assembly. I covered the trials and tribulations of this document last episode, but here it was, finally on board the most modern of vessels, a mail steamer called the Lady Jocelyn that sailed into Table Bay in 1853. The first governor to arrive after this envelope would no longer have the power to make any decisions arbitrarily for the first time in South Africa's history since the days of Jan van Riebeck and Simon van der Stel and all the others. The man in charge of the Cape could no longer rule singularly. The new franchise was extended to all male British subjects, or to put it another way, all males born in the Cape Colony. There was no distinction made between classes and creeds, between whites and blacks, Khoi, freed slave, Amamfengu. To vote, though,
You had to prove occupation of a premises worth 25 British pounds for a year, or you had to earn an annual salary of at least 50 pounds. Voting was not cast in a physical ballot. Oh no, it was word of mouth. Verbal voting, so that even illiterate men could make the decision known. And although it's hard to fathom, this was supported by the Dutch, the Afrikaans of the day, as much as by the Khoikhoi. Most of the rural Boers actually had less education in this time as urbanized Khoi and coloureds. The Dutch-speaking representatives had argued vociferously for verbal voting, while the English settlers, yes, you guessed it, were against it, because most of the English settlers could read and write. Robert Godlinton, yes, him again, railed against verbal voting too, warning it would lead to all manner of ill-considered decisions, letting people who couldn't read and write vote. By this, he was aiming at the Dutch, the Boers, more than he was at the Khoikhoi and the coloureds, because, you know, South African history is like that, all kind of muddled and jumbled. Most blacks living in the Cape were not born there. They were born in the Amatolas, British Kaffraria, the Albany district, Basutoland, the Free State, Transorangia, the Transkei. This meant they couldn't vote. Most of the coloured voters couldn't vote either. They just didn't have the £50 a year income, let alone could prove they lived in a house or a hut worth at least £25 a year. Next episode, we'll leap across the Orange River back into the seemingly interminable and fractious intra-Boer political marathons. We'll also take a quick gander at what was going on across planet Earth in 1853, incidents and events that deflected back into Africa, changing the game. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate the visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about episodes. You can sign up for my newsletter there, or you can email me from there too. Until next, tot ziens.